All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 7th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. We've almost made it. It is 42 degrees and really overcast, looking like it's going to rain here any second in upstate New York. But the snow is almost gone, and actually, we just got an update. It's 52, not 42. I don't know. My little app, first time I loaded it, said it was 0 degrees Fahrenheit. I had to close it and reopen it, so I guess it's warmer than I thought. It's 52 degrees and overcast, so you know what? I'll give a hooray for that. My piles of snow from last weekend are almost gone. All right, so where we leave off yesterday, we titled the show Government Override on Self-Driving Cars, AI, and Robot Naughty Bits. I told you I was going to call it that. We looked at some pretty disturbing things. One was how, with these new self-driving autonomous vehicles, law enforcement, of course, is looking at how to get their grubby little hands to be able to intercept you at any time, redirect you, maintain privacy of certain locations so you cannot drive the self-driving car there. It will not take you as a means of control. Now, self-driving cars scare me. Remember, we took a look a while ago at some of the AI algorithms, you know, that have been dubbed equivalents to humans to be able to drive these things. And one of the things that they had talked about is in regards to ethical dilemmas. What happens when you are careening toward a brick wall? Does the car step on the brakes? Oh, but wait, the algorithm determined that the brakes aren't going to save you. Well, so does it turn the wheel? Well, there's 50 people on the sidewalk over there. And if we careen into the 50 people, you might kill 10 or 12, and that's a lot more than just running into the brick wall and killing you. And so it might determine on its own that it is better to kill you than to potentially harm the 50 pedestrians on the sidewalk. Remember, too, when we talked about this, there's that law. It's not a law. It's like a natural law, where every living creature, when it is faced with impending doom, comes back and tries to fight for like the last second for self-preservation. And there aren't any ethical thoughts to that. There aren't any, oh, you know, am I going to be doing something bad by killing somebody else to keep myself alive? I mean, think about when you have a drowning man or woman, anybody, a drowning person, and you swim out to save that person. And one of the things they tell you in lifeguard school, because I did, I took that class years and years ago, and all the, CPR, whatever stuff way back. But one of the things they teach you when going in to save somebody who is drowning is don't get too close to them. Because that person isn't thinking about any morality, the morality of grabbing you by the hair and trying to climb on top of your head to get themselves out of the water. The drowning person is panicking and trying to preserve life and limb. And it's an instinct that takes over, that puts you into that driver's seat. You as an organism, that's all it cares about, is to make you survive. So we had talked about the ethical dilemma with the self-driving cars way back when. If we are no longer in control, I mean, if I was driving my own car and all of a sudden a brick wall just appeared out of nowhere and I was about ready to slam into it, you know what? My first response is going to be to try to hit the brakes, but if I'm going too fast, I'm going to make a hard right. I don't care what the hell's next to me. Maybe there's a car next to me. I might smash into the car or a sidewalk with 50 people on it. You know what? It doesn't matter because it's self-preservation. And like I've said before, there's also personal responsibility. Those 50 people on the sidewalk need to have situational awareness, because if there is a danger coming toward them, it is their responsibility to get out of the way. So I really, you know, this artificial intelligence making decisions for us, and we are just at the very beginning cusp of all of this. And I already see ethical issues for things that haven't even rolled out yet. How do you think it's going to be when we have robot doctors and robot proctologists, robot home helpers, little Fitbits in your blood like Kurzweil was talking about the other day, making all your decisions for you? This is not going to be a very utopian world like they keep trying to premise us. We talked about Beidou yesterday. It's the equivalent of Google over in China. And how they are trying to integrate artificial intelligence into all of their different products. They also have a supercomputer that they are working on and all kinds of neat little applications. And I happen to see after the show, guess who else is working on their own self-driving car? Not only that, but testing it in the U.S. Now, we also found out looking at Beidou that they are working with the United States, which I find very odd. A Chinese supercomputing giant working on U.S. soil at one of the universities, I believe they said. I don't know if it was this story from yesterday or if it was from the day before when we looked at it, but they had said that China has Beidou in working on one of the campuses at some center for artificial learning. I thought that was very odd. I mean, I guess it's better to keep your enemies close so you know what they're doing. On the other hand, China and Google, so Beidou and Google working together hand in hand is a very frightening, frightening concept. Beidou will test its self-driving car in the U.S. It's from just the other day. Chinese search giant Beidou is planning to test its autonomous cars in the United States with the goal of building a, quote, commercially viable, unquote, car by 2018, says the Wall Street Journal. Firm announced last year that it was looking to develop vehicles that could serve as public shuttles. And the company told the journal that it has a 160-strong office in Sunnyvale, California, with many employees working on the car project. So Beidou has an office in California with 160 employees working just on their self-driving car project. And, you know, that's the other thing that we've been digging into is taking a look at all these Silicon Valley companies and companies that were traditionally not Silicon Valley that are moving offices there to get into the game. And it's really, really amazing at how many different companies are getting into this. And especially from the car perspective, Ford, GM, we saw Toyota. Now, Toyota is just dropping another big chunk of change. We saw yesterday opening their connected unit for allowing cars to communicate with each other and have it suck data that then it can put into some sort of dashboard to be able to gather intelligence. And I'm sure what they will do is monetize that by selling it as software as a service, access to places like insurance companies to be able to spy on habits of drivers. Anyway, back to this. Back in 2014, BMW and Beidou announced a partnership to work on self-driving cars. So BMW sided with the Chinese company, saying that the two companies hope to launch a car together before the end of 2015. Well, that hasn't happened yet. But Beidou said last year that it was currently focused on more assisting a driver rather than replacing them entirely. And that's something we've talked about before as well. I mean, do not, please, take my advice, do not ever get into a Google self-driving car with no steering wheel, no pedal, and no accelerator because it is a death box. You have no way to control the car or override anything. It'll have little cameras in there that'll be able to identify who you are, search your dossier, and then decide immediately whether or not you are somebody maybe on the red list, you know? And I see that working out pretty well for them in the future. All these little conveniences that they'll be able to give us for free. Get all the little rats running out from underneath rocks to the cheese. It's the way they're looking at this. This is going to give them full control. So I don't know. Thumbs up to Beidou if they're the ones that are actually going to put steering wheels and be an assisted driver. I mean, I could see this. I don't think I would mind at all. All right, I'm going to give you this machine. I don't think I'd mind at all if I had some better dashboard accessories that gave me a little more details rather than just the glowing light. You know, I mean, you could even have a voice and talk to me, Cortana. You know, there is an issue coming up 10 miles up the road, kind of like a GPS on steroids that's also maintaining diagnostics on my car. I might even be okay with that. I'm not okay with handing it off to who knows who. I'm not okay with you taking control of the car for me without my permission. Would be nice in a whiteout snowstorm like we tend to get here up near the Great Lakes. We get lake effect snow. So you could be driving for 50 miles and it's clear as a bell, just cold. And then all of a sudden, bang, 5 seconds, you're in a complete whiteout, like slippery, 7 inches on the ground. Everybody slamming on their brakes, sliding everywhere. Whiteout snowstorm just out of nowhere. It's easy. It happens. It's happened to me a lot of times. And fearing that you're never going to make it out the other side, 3 hours later as your fingers are blue from holding the steering wheel so tight and you couldn't see. Actually, I did that. I followed a U-Haul doing 10 miles an hour with its emergency flashers. I was right on his bumper the whole time. He could have been towing me from Buffalo to Rochester in this whiteout snowstorm. And you know what? The dude could have been driving off the road. I would have had no idea. It was so horrible. But, you know, they had a self-driving car that could use, like, GPS and navigate in a whiteout blizzard snowstorm or a haboob if you were down in the Southwest. Or, you know, typhoons like we get sometimes. You know, that would be helpful. But otherwise, I want to do it myself. Thank you very much. All right. Anyway, yesterday, a number of executives from companies working on self-driving cars testified in front of a U.S. Senate committee. And I mentioned that we have already talked about Google being in Washington, pressuring them to unify self-driving car laws across the board so it'll be easy for them to roll these things out. That's what you get when you go to Washington a lot and you spend millions of dollars on lobbyists to go butt-pat congressmen. And they already gave the green light to the AI for Google self-driving cars being a legal driving entity. Anyway, a number of executives from companies working on self-driving cars testified in front of a U.S. Senate committee to discuss possible safety regulations and the state of the autonomous car industry. Beidou is one of many working on cars, but if its cars are ready for testing on the American roads, the company would seem to find itself in good company. Dun, dun, dun. Self-driving car makers deflect privacy and security questions in Congress. Yeah, it looks like, you know, they're asking a lot of questions. These guys don't want questions asked. Executives from Google, General Motors, Delphi, they're up here in Buffalo, and Lyft, L-Y-F-T, appeared before a U.S. Senate committee on Tuesday, March 15th, to testify on their latest efforts to bring self-driving cars to the public, but asked whether they support a bill to require anti-hacking safeguards and connect in autonomous cars. And remember, we talked about that yesterday. Those cars are so beyond hackable right now. And there have been congressmen and different lawmakers out there warning that if they let these things go on the road the way they are, people are going to die. And it might not be the self-driving car taking control on its own that kills somebody. Though, like I said, I pointed out that algorithm to kill less people if there's an accident, that might kill people. But they are talking about the ability, as shown in 60 Minutes with DARPA Dan, how easy it is to hack a vehicle and take control of its systems. You know, even after that, after everyone came out and said, oh, no, 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 DARPA Dan exaggerated how easy it was to hack into things. Well, actually, he didn't. But after that, somebody hacked a Jeep Cherokee to boot and showed how simple it was. And by the way, the DARPA clip I had mentioned yesterday in regards to that woman talking about hacking the cars long before Michael Hastings, I found it. I had to remember the keywords. Her name is Kathleen Fisher, and she's program manager out of DARPA. The video came out in 2012. It's on DARPA TV YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/DARPA TV. And if you just search DARPA Kathleen Fisher, you will find it. It's called DARPA PM Kathleen Fisher, High Assurance Systems. And this is talking about all these autonomous systems out there and how easy they are to be hacked. And that's where she mentions that they can even hack these cars with a plain, simple CD by putting something in under, I was assuming under the music, tone-wise, that could activate different things within the car, whether it be your windshield or your windshield wipers or your brakes. So, you know, and the fact that they're making a big deal about this on Capitol Hill, you know, worries me, because these guys usually just go along with the agenda. Anyway, but when asked whether they support a bill to require anti-hacking safeguards in connected and autonomous cars, the car companies studied through a series of non-answers. Their reticence isn't unusual. Most corporate-minded individuals view the prospect of new government mandates with a certain queasiness, but the squirming on display in Congress today, ding, ding, could hint at a future conflict down the road should lawmakers continue to pursue legal checks on the new self-driving vehicle technology. Like, how dare they? How dare regulatory agencies put safety regulations and privacy regulations on this unchecked takeover by technology? How dare they? We gave them $1 bazillion. That meant shut up and let it pass. And here, Ed Markey, he's the congressman I was talking about that introduced the bill trying to force these car companies to fix all these big gaping holes in security. The questioning was led by Senator Edward Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts, who's sponsoring a bill with Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut, to require the Federal Trade Commission and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to develop standards to protect drivers' privacy and to potentially stop deadly hacks. Markey went down the line, asking each of the executives to state yes or no as to whether they supported mandatory privacy and safety standards. And in response, he got a lot of deflection, as you would imagine. We haven't determined whether we need mandatory standards or not, says Glenn DeVos, vice president for global engineering at Delphi. So we haven't determined yet whether we need standards. No. We think we need a more flexible approach. That's more preferable, says Mike Abelson, vice president of GM. Google is attacked on a regular basis, said that company's head of self-driving cars, Chris Urmson. We have hundreds of people devoted to cybersecurity. The translation, butt out, Mr. Senator. That's what I said. We gave you more than enough money already. Shut up, zip it. We want to be able to get these things rolling. There's lots of money behind it. And we're all sitting there chomping at the bit with our stock options ready to roll. Markey was not happy with these responses. He said, I understand what you're saying. Well, I hope he gave it to him. Witnesses sat here 30 years ago and said the same thing about airbags and seatbelts. Zing! How could they leave that to the individual companies. It was really hard to mandate specific airbags, and it would be really, really expensive. Yeah, kind of like GMO labeling, too. You hear that same sob story. Boo-hoo. So I understand the consistency over these decades with your complaints. And at the same time, people expect airbags to protect their children, and they're going to expect certain standards across the board that are going to protect people. So there you go. In introducing his bill last year, Markey's office released a report that found nearly all cars on the market include wireless technology that could be vulnerable. And this is also this wireless technology that they were talking about now making like a wireless mesh network. And we used to have Muni wireless, where if you go downtown, you might be able to sit in the park and have a free hotspot or whatever, like they have at Starbucks. A lot of the municipalities and the cities were selling that, you know, as a way to bring companies back into the downtowns years ago. And you would set it up with radios so they could all be overlapping, and you'd have this, what they'd call a mesh, pretty much across the whole city. Well, it got expensive if you were offering it for free. And I see now a lot of cities are offering like a, you know, a few dollars a month deal to be able to get it. And hey, when you got to upgrade, you know, who's going to pay for it? I'm running into that here. You know, free is free until you got to upgrade, and then it's no longer free, or you got to pay the bills. But one of the new things they've been talking about, launching all these self-driving cars, is just have wireless technology in the car itself, pulling from, you know, probably one of the new Google 24/7 flying drone internet things overhead, or maybe a Google Loon balloon to get the internet. But it's ubiquitous internet, they're saying, everywhere. Be able to get 5G at least. And once each car gets internet, then they can mesh between the cars, and now you got a big internet mesh everywhere that's being provided by the vehicles to the last mile of the end user. But yeah, I bet most of us didn't know that there's wireless already built into most cars, but that's one of the things that they were thinking about doing with it. During the hearing, he recalled a more personal incident when he was hit by the car at the age of 5 while chasing two other children in the road. And as we're moving forward, he says, we just want to make sure that we don't have any unnecessary accidents. Do, do, do. All right, so self-driving cars, I think we're going to leave those on the back burner for now. So pay attention. Car manufacturers, as well as the big internet giants, and remember, Apple is also included in those self-driving car projects that they're working on. There is a lot on the way. We also found out the self-driving tractor trailer. Back when we did self-driving a few months ago, I had also dug up, I was joking about there being a self-driving school bus at some point in the future. And after the show, I searched it, and guess what? They're working on one of those too. Unmanned aerial whatever's flying gremlins, loading up the belly of a C-130 to let a swarm of little nasties go. And this is a pretty frightening future. I just saw yesterday too, you know, back a few months ago, we discovered that Google had filed a patent for the autonomous drones that'll be used to deliver medicine. So like autonomous medevac drones. Well, guess what? There is a company out of California called Zipline, I believe. It looks like they got venture capital from Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft. And they've started doing the first tests, delivering medical supplies in Rwanda. Yes, what a great place to test it, in Africa. But someday we'll have that medevac Google drone flying to your front door, as well as Amazon delivering, Walmart. It's going to be just all kinds of crazy. All right, so where do we go from here? MIT Technology Review, self-taught robots. We've talked about this, talked about Baxter, we talked about them uploading knowledge to this Borg cloud that all these robots be able to tap off of, and the self-learning robots that Google and a Japanese firm are working on two separate projects where they can give a robot a task. The robot uses its VPU, its vision, to takes images, takes shots. And each time it does the process, it takes pictures, figures out what it does wrong. And by the morning, it will have trained itself in the entire process and procedure that you've assigned it to. Of course, this will be wonderful for robots taking over all the factory jobs. Well, now, self-taught robot is ready to seize another warehouse job. A keen-eyed new robot looks poised to snag an important everyday warehouse job. Kinema Systems, another startup. There's just so many startups everywhere. Based in Menlo Park, California, has developed a robot capable of breaking down pallets of boxes, no matter what size or shape they are or how they are packed together. This is a routine job at thousands of large stores, warehouses, and shipping companies. The aftermath of goods making their way through the supply line to your front door. This new robot uses simple suction systems to grab boxes, but it needs a state-of-the-art computer vision. Told you, there's that VPU. They're giving them senses, guys. State-of-the-art computer vision and machine learning to figure out how to grab them. The machine does not need to be programmed at all. Remember, they learn on their own now. And we also discovered that robots will evolve. They were doing some experiments on that in the lab already, and they showed a mother robot building baby robots and how any of her foibles were kept out of the new baby robot. So the baby robot was better than she was. Giving it anthropomorphic qualities. Anyway, the machine does not need to be programmed at all. Instead, it automatically calibrates itself and teaches itself how to break down boxes. This might be trivial for humans to grab a box, but it is hard for a computer to know where one box ends and another begins, especially if the boxes are covered with labels and packing tape, and if the robot does not place its suction device at the end of a box. There is a risk that it'll drop it. Sachina Chita, founder and CEO of Kinema, says the robot uses a combination of 2D and 3D vision as well as learning in order to grab boxes from a pallet. And the learning process also helps the robot deal with different environmental conditions such as changes in lighting. As it picks up things, it builds a model of each box. And in the future, it can use this model to speed things up. And what's really frightening about these learning robots is that anything they encounter, they're using as a learning experience. So we are unwittingly feeding data into the machine every day with stuff that we do online, whether it be, you know, I'm talking into Skype right now. Well, I'm sure my voice is being encoded. They're translating it, trying to figure out things that I'm saying, because that's Microsoft's big thing here with translation. And I'm sure Google is taking all the weird searches that I do and trying to put together some sort of idea about what I'm going to do next. This whole predictive programming thing that they're working on, or where I'm going to click, or I don't know, how could they can screw up my machine because I'm getting too close to the truth, make everything crash and burn. You know, that happens often out of the blue for no reason, too. Anyway, back to this. It takes human workers about 6 seconds on an average to grab a box from a pallet. And beyond breaking down pallets, Cheetah says, the company plans to use similar technologies to let robots manipulate unfamiliar objects, which could be valuable for many warehouse and factory tasks. Machines capable of unpacking pallets already exist, but they typically rely on standard shape and arrangement. And efforts to break down more complex pallets using robots have mostly relied on specialized labels to identify them. You know, the thing is, if we start looking at how they're incrementally taking away all of these commonly blue-collar jobs where people had employment, made some decent money, and it's not just one or two companies. I mean, we're looking at across the gamut now of tech companies and companies that were never into technology that are really sticking both feet in, saying this is the way of the future, finding ways to replace humans. And we looked at that. I mean, they're saying at least 50% of all the jobs over the next few years now are going to be replaced by automation. We have Samsung building their army of robots for factory automation. You have Toyota now. You have Google working on it. Google also owns those 8 robotics companies and Boston Dynamics. You know, there's questions as to whether it's going to go to Amazon, who's also building their own robots for warehouse, or to Toyota. I think it's going to go to Toyota. Put on a seatbelt. So there's a story that came out of Forbes April 5th. So this is just a few days back. Why everyone must get ready for the 4th Industrial Revolution. First came steam and water power, then electricity and assembly lines. Then computerization. So what is to come next? Some call it the 4th Industrial Revolution or Industry 4.0, but whatever you call it, it represents the combination of cyber physical systems, the Internet of Things, ding ding, of which you and I will become a part, and the Internet of Systems. And we discovered that term the other day in regards to the self-driving cars. They are forming this Internet of Systems, all of these machines that will be able to collaborate and work together to learn, to make decisions, to be able to interoperate properly. And then the Internet of Things will be the endpoint, like you, me, Nana, your coffee maker, refrigerator, your smart thermostat in your house. That will be the Internet of Things. In short, this is the idea where smart factories in which machines are augmented with web connectivity and connected to a system that can visualize the entire production chain and make decisions on its own. And it is well on its way, and it will change most of our jobs. And remember, too, this isn't just about factory jobs. I mean, we've been reading stories where they're talking about lawyers, journalists, doctors, typically occupations that required an education, required some creativity, required the human mind to be able to do successfully. But now with this AI, knowledge repositories, cloud-based learning. You know, we looked pretty deeply at some stuff that they're doing with IBM Watson, and he's already working with the Sloan Kettering Institute, working on cancer diagnoses and things. You know, it's not going to be too much longer before we start seeing some really big mass unemployment. And, of course, their solution is to give us money falling from the sky with their universal basic income, which isn't going to work out too well, people. Professor Klaus Schwab, founder and executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, has published a book entitled The 4th Industrial Revolution. How nice. He's the president of the World Economic Forum, i.e. Davos. So, you know, they've been talking about this at Davos for a while. Don't think that they aren't fully aware in orchestrating this happening. He's published a book titled The 4th Industrial Revolution, in which he describes how this 4th revolution is fundamentally different from the last previous 3, which were characterized mainly by advances in technology. In this 4th revolution, we are facing a new range that combine the physical, digital, and oh no, and this has been all we talked about, the biological worlds. This is the merging of man and machine. This is the merging of biology and synthetic. And if we can keep going here and getting through these stories, we might actually get to some of the new stuff in the biological synthetic merging that I've had queued up here all week. These new technologies will impact all disciplines, economies, and industries, and even challenge our ideas about what it means to be what? Human. Yes, human 2.0 coming to a newborn unit near you. These technologies have great potential to continue to connect billions of more people to the web, drastically improving the efficiency of business and organizations, and help regenerate the natural environment. Ding! Remember the DARPA lady talking about DARPA planning on terraforming Mars in the future, but we're going to use the Earth as our test bed to terraform environments that have been so destroyed by pollution with these synthetic microbes that they've been designing at the Department of Energy. No, thank you. But you know, this is all happening, people, and it is happening without your consent or mine. We are being assimilated. They made that decision at these global economic forums that we are no longer needed. We're too expensive to pay for labor, and you know what? We got this TPP and the TTIP coming, which means we need dirt cheap labor. We don't want to be paying wages or vacations or health care or pensions. No, too expensive. Get a Baxter, $29.95. No, Baxter was like $35,000, I think I read, but the price is coming down. As more and more people want it, supply and demand, the price goes lower. It says, anyway, and it'll help regenerate our natural environment through better asset management. So, yeah, bag and tag every plant. Part of the Internet of Things, and potentially even undo all of the damage that the previous industrial revolutions have caused. Again, that's the terraforming stuff. I'm telling you, this is so bad news. The most people only know the tip of the iceberg. And they're like, oh, DARPA's got some scary drones. Well, that's not even it, guys. That's like the happy, scary face of DARPA. There's mad science gone mad, absolute lunatic off the edge science going on right now that they've been sprinkling all over. And one of these days when it becomes apparent to too many people, they're going to go, oh, well, it's too late now. Where were you guys when we were working on this? There are a lot of scientists that are saying, back up the truck. We cannot have this. Where are the morals and ethics? Why are we not doing more research? But it's not happening. Psychopathic personalities are in charge. And that means 120 miles an hour to the brick wall and threaten you. That's what they do. We're all going to die. Woo! Give it up. No more carbon. Carbon quotient needs to come to zero, per Bill Gates at the TED conference a couple years back. All right. But there are also grave potential risks involved in this, and Schwab outlines his concerns that organizations could be unable or unwilling. Yes, resistant consumers sound like they are also worried about resistant corporations. Organizations that could be unable or unwilling to adapt these new technologies, and that there are governments that could fail to employ or regulate these technologies properly. We will be the rogue ones on that state-sponsored terror list if you do not comply. And of course, they're going to do it all in the name of carbon credits, climate change, this whole COP21 conference that they had a few months back in Geneva. Let's get everybody on board because global warming is happening. Except I've seen some things now. You know, the NASA satellites came out after they were threatening just a few days before saying, oh, the water level is going to rise so high when Antarctica melts that we're just going to lose Florida and New York City and all these places. And then a few days later, it's like, get your story straight, guys. NASA releases a study showing how the Antarctic ice shelf is actually increasing in size. And of course, they had science behind that where they're explaining, well, it doesn't mean that, but it is getting bigger. So who knows? When I see things are cyclical. There's been some crazy astronomical news lately about them thinking that now they really have found planet quote unquote 9, formerly known as planet X. They also found evidence of this cyclical 27 million year extinction cycle on Earth. And it seems to correlate with the orbit of this mysterious planet 9. So, hey, the Sumerians might have been right. But, you know, don't worry about any of that. Worry about automation. Worry about giving up all your jobs. Worry about becoming a hybrid of biological and synthetic, moving toward Kurzweil's wet dream of the singularity as Google and DARPA give him unlimited funding to be able to accomplish that. Anyway, back to the story. I rambled too much. In the book, Schwab postulates, and this is the guy from the Davos Forum, that shifting power will create important new security concerns. Of course, it's always about your safety. And that inequities could grow rather than shrink if things are not managed properly. Yeah, like what? You put the whole world out of work, so nobody has a job, nobody has money, nobody has resources to be able to participate in your system. Of course there's going to be inequities. I would have to say that inequities is a little bit of an understatement. It says, for example, and here we go, as automation increases, computers and machines will replace workers across a vast spectrum of industries, from drivers to accountants and real estate agents to insurance agents. And by one estimate, as many as 47% of U.S. jobs are at risk from automation. I mean, we've seen a few different studies. I've seen 50% or more within the next 4 years, and then you see within the next 10, so timeline's a little off there. But then we saw just recently, by like 2025, they're saying 90% of all jobs will be gone globally. That's going to turn the entire planet into a third world planet. It's going to make us all poor and begging for somebody to provide a sustenance, for someone to help us grow food, because they've destroyed the climate with all their sprays and aerosols and whatever the hell else they're doing, their cloud seeding. But all kinds of stories now about their cloud seeding in California. I mean, we've known that was happening for a long time, but after the Chinese Beijing Olympics, you know, that came out into the public eye. But still, there's not going to be any way for us to maintain life and limb if every job is gone and there is no money in the economy anywhere that's going to be able to even purchase products, which again makes us all a bunch of useless eaters. And as they sprinkle us this universal basic income and give the world free money, don't think that you're going to be any type of important except as some sort of A, research rat, or B, I was just seeing they cracked some code where they were able to do a reverse photosynthesis. Did you see that? So instead of taking in sunlight and creating energy, they are now able to break down the plant material, and they're thinking maybe other biological biomass material, break it down and get energy out of it. So in the end, they'll be able to have green energy. Well, you and I are biomass too. Just saying. Many experts suggest that the fourth industrial revolution will benefit the rich much more than the poor, you think? Especially as low-skilled, low-wage jobs disappear in favor of automation. And soon it's going to be high-skilled jobs as well. But this isn't new. Historically, industrial revolutions have always begun with greater inequality, followed by periods of political and institutional change. Yes, and upheaval. The industrial revolution that began at the beginning of the 19th century originally led to huge polarization of wealth and power before, that was where the Rockefellers and everything came from, wasn't it? Before being followed by nearly 100 years of change, including the spread of democracy, trade unions, progressive taxation, and the development of safety nets. Well, I'd have to say, if I had my choice, I don't think I'd want to be living in the beginning of the 19th century where all that crap was going on either. Seems a safe bet to say then that our current political, business, and social structures may not be ready or capable of absorbing all of the changes the Fourth Industrial Revolution would bring, and that major changes to the very structure of our society might be inevitable. Like I've been saying, you know, everyone's been talking about this crash. Oh, we're going to have a global crash. Oh, watch the price of gold. Okay, it's all manipulated. It's only going to crash when they want it to crash. They're going to give infusions and, you know, backdoors, whatever they're doing, slipping gold around the globe and letting rich billionaires get off the hook until it's go time. And when it's go time, they're going to blame it on all the robots. That's all. It's not going to be a financial crash. There just aren't going to be any more jobs. But look, Johnny, we got this universal basic income, so it's going to be all better. We'll just give you money every month. Oh, wait, but money's dirty. And got to kill trees to print it anyway, because we don't do it on hemp anymore. So let's just make it all digital. Let's make it all digital. We'll give everybody access using their biometrics. And oh, by the way, you know, like I said, this is part of the Internet of Things. Maybe now even the Internet of Systems, where they all work together. Your car door to let you into your self-driving car, your biometric scan to get into your house. Being able to get on the internet with your biometrics so you are approved is not a rogue who's putting some sort of untruthfulness that Google's truth algorithm is now fighting against. Schwab says the changes are so profound that from the perspective of human history, there has never been a time of greater promise or potential peril. Ding, 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 ding. I'm on the peril side of things. I don't think this is going to be great promise. Like I said, it is not the white-roomed happy utopia where everyone's smiling and medicated and provided for. This is the dark, scary hallway with the door at the end with the bloody handprints that we're heading toward. Back to the story. This is the Schwab again from Davos. My concern, however, is that decision makers are too often caught in the traditional linear and non-disruptive thinking. This is what I was talking about. All of these are considered disruptive technologies. And when you unleash one disruptive technology, you turn an entire industry on its head. We are talking about unleashing 100 disruptive technologies right now. All these different things that we're talking about between nanotechnology and synthetic biology and the brain project and all this other crap. You're going to take all these disruptive technologies and take the entire world and flip it on its head is what is coming, people. People don't get that yet. It's all status quo. You know, let's keep doing what we're doing. I'm worrying about politics. It's not about politics. This is about the survival of a species. This is about the survival of a country. It's going away. You know, that whole New World Order all under one umbrella. I always used to think that that was completely lunatic. This whole eugenics thing, too many people on the planet. I used to think that was completely lunatic too. And you know, the more and more we dig and the further and further into the future we get and more we see as to how all things are playing out here, I don't think any of it is lunatic anymore. I could absolutely see where this whole agenda is heading. And it's not going to be for the good of you or me. There's too many of us right now for them to control. However, my concern is, back to the story, that the decision makers are often too caught in traditional, linear, and non-disruptive thinking or too absorbed by the immediate concerns to think strategically about the forces of disruption and innovation shaping our future. In order to thrive, business leaders will have to actively work to expand their thinking away from what has been traditionally done, including ideas and systems that may never have been considered. Business leaders must begin to question everything, from rethinking their strategies and business models to discovering the right investments in training and potentially disruptive R&D developments and investments. And, you know, that is what these rich tech billionaires have been doing, is using their R&D investments in disruptive technology research. It's frightening, because if this is a guy from Davos who's warning the corporate elite around the world that they better get with the game plan, because what's coming is more disruptive than anything that has ever happened in the history of mankind. Guys, you better believe it. And I guess we're probably going to hit this last story. This one talks about China also getting in the game of a cashless future. Bring on the cashless future, says Bloomberg. Cash has had a pretty good run for 4,000 years or so. And in these days, though, notes and coins increasingly seem déclassé. They're dirty and dangerous, unwieldy and expensive, antiquated, and so very analog. Did they just say that about money? I mean, dirty, yes. When I touch a dollar bill, I gotta wash my hands. Dangerous? Really? Oh, maybe it can fund terrorists under the table. Unwieldy? Like, I don't have dollar bills fighting in my pocket. Expensive? Well, maybe. The Federal Reserve. Antiquated and analog? Come on. I mean, they're pushing this, guys. It's coming. Digital currency is coming. They're going to flick that domino. Release the robots. All the jobs disappear. Now what are you going to do about it? Anyway, sensing this dissatisfaction with cash, entrepreneurs have introduced hundreds of digital currencies in the past few years, of which Bitcoin is only the most famous. Now the governments want in. The People's Bank of China says it intends to issue a digital currency of its own. And central banks in Ecuador, the Philippines, the UK, and Canada are also mulling similar ideas. Ding, ding, ding. And at least one company thought about it and figured out how to make some profits. They've now sprung up to help them all along. Much depends on details, of course, but this is a welcoming trend. In theory, digital legal tender could combine the inventiveness of private virtual currencies with the stability of a government mint. Oh, yes. Let's put the digital currencies that were rogue-backed and out there into the hands of the government. That's what's coming, people. This is that universal basic income kind of coupled with the universal ID card. You know, over 1 billion people bagged and tagged in an experiment with IBM in India. Back a few years ago, Brandon Turville did a story about that on Activist Post. 1 billion people in this universal ID marching toward this cashless society. Most obviously, such a system would make moving money way easier. Properly designed, a digital fiat currency can move seamlessly across otherwise incompatible payment networks, making transactions faster and cheaper. And it would be of particular use to the poor, who could then pay their bills or accept payments online without the need of a bank account or make remittances without getting gouged. Yes, of course, it's all in the name of the poor. The poor paying their bills. Let's make it all digital, people. And for governments and their taxpayers, potential savings abound. Issuing digital currencies would be cheaper than printing bills and minting coins. And it could improve statistical indicators such as inflation and gross domestic product. Yes, and nobody will be able to pay for anything under the table because they can bag, tag, and track every qubit. And here we go. Traceable transactions could help inhibit terrorist financing, all in the name of safety, money laundering, fraud, tax evasion, and corruption. And how interesting. We're reading the story today after the last few days of revelations with the Panama Papers. The most far-reaching effects might be on monetary policy. For much of the past decade, central banks in the rich world have been hampered by what economists call zero lower bound, or the inability to impose significantly negative interest rates. Well, thank goodness, because I would think that a negative interest rate would be an indicator of some really bad economies. Persistent low demand and high unemployment may sometimes require interest rates to be pushed below zero. Well, there we go. That is what that means. It means nobody's borrowing and nobody's spending because nobody's got any money. So now they're trying to give it away. But why keep money in a deposit whose value keeps shrinking when you can hold that cash instead, right? Don't save shit. That isn't the way the world works. Buy, 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 spend, spend, spend. That's all about capitalism. And with rates near zero now, that conundrum has led policymakers to novel and unpredictable methods of stimulating the economy, such as large-scale bond buying. A digital legal tender could resolve this problem, thank goodness. Suppose the central banks charge the bank that deal with a fee for accepting paper currency. And in a way that could set an exchange rate between electronic and paper money. By raising the fee, it would cause paper money to depreciate against the electronic standard. What? So if you're holding paper money, they're going to make it go worth less and make electronic currency worth more. So eventually, in the end, your paper money won't be worth anything. So you know what? You resisting consumers, give it up now. Otherwise, you'll have nothing. This would eliminate the incentive to hold cash rather than digital money. Yes, force us. Force us. And allow the central bank to push the interest rate below zero and thereby boost consumption and investment. Man, talk about a completely rigged system. Governments must be alert to problems because the key to getting people to adopt such a digital currency system is trust, a rule that a person's transaction history could only be accessed with a court order, for instance, might alleviate privacy concerns and harmonizing international regulations. Yes, of course, one world government could encourage companies to keep experimenting. All right, guys, well, we'll continue on this tomorrow, if you can believe it. The show is already done. Make sure you stick around. It's Thursday. Mr. Kevin Blanche is live up next, 3 p.m. Eastern. Ocelli Effect brand new this afternoon. 7 p.m. live with Game On Run. Behind the Woodshed this week at 8.